I neglected to initial the comments that I passed along to you in the bulletin from Trevor Srim. I wanted you to know that those comments were my excerpts from some things he had had to say, and I do recommend them to everybody in the church who will conduct meetings. If you want to know more about Trevor, I will talk about him sometime. In the rhythm of church life, the second Sunday after Easter is still a quiet time after the full house and sounding brass and the hallelujahs of the choir. And for us, as Mary Ellen said, the opening Sunday in our new church is still some 4 weeks away. So in this slight lull, I would like to use the pulpit this morning a little more selfishly than I would normally do. I need to get out of my system some things I've read and heard recently from the religious scene, but not, I promise, quickly, anything about Jim and Tammy, who have troubles enough without my help. What amazes me is how much misinformation is spread around in the name of religion. I have no intention of devoting my life to corrections, but I do think it might be useful to remind you once in a while to be skeptical of what you read. At the bottom of page 3 in your bulletin, we've reproduced a paragraph from an editorial in the Easter edition of the newspaper. Let's read it, and then as we talk about it later on for a moment or so, you can look back at it when you need to. 4 different gospel writers say that that on the third day after he died on a cross, at least 2 women named Mary went to a sealed tomb to embalm Jesus' body and found the tomb open and the burial wrappings empty. Then the Bible says they were greeted by a glowing figure they eventually recognized as the person whose body they had come to prepare for final entombment. I don't imagine there is a large readership for the Easter editorial, but as a minister who has to talk about Easter every year, I can't resist wondering what an editor will say, so I read it. And this paragraph particularly caught my eye. Just 2 sentences that sound innocent and sweet, but that are inaccurate in at least 4 ways. For example, 4 different gospel writers say 2 Marys went to the tomb. The fact is that John, whose recollection is so different from the other gospel writers, has only 1 Mary. The editorial says they went to embalm the body. 2 of the gospels say that, but Matthew says only that they went to see the body, not a word about embalming. And John makes no comment at all about why Mary went to the tomb. He could not very well say that she was going to embalm, even though the other Gospels had done so, because earlier in his story, he has had 2 male disciples do that already. Our paragraph says that the women found the burial wrappings empty. The truth is that not one of the 4 Gospels says anything at all about the women finding the burial wrappings. The only gospel that says anything about the wrappings is John's, and he has two male disciples find them. Our paragraph also says the women were greeted by a glowing figure who turned out to be Christ. You could hunt that incident in the Gospels until Judgment Day, and you wouldn't find it. The editorial writer has apparently confused Christ with the messengers who appear in the stories. But the moment you make that adjustment, you have some other problems. Matthew describes a single dazzling angel. He uses the Greek word angelos. Mark describes a single young man. Luke has two men in dazzling dress. John has two angels in white. It is impossible to harmonize these discrepant numbers or the differing messages which these characters deliver. The four Gospels are really surprisingly at odds with each other in the way they tell the story of the resurrection. About the only thing they agree on is that a resurrection was reported. They don't agree on how that was done. They don't agree on how the announcement of it was received by the disciples. Is it only nitpicking to care? Should we even bother to notice? My own feeling is that all carelessness, like the one in this editorial, having to do with the Bible, distorts the kind of book it is. It makes the Bible seem simplistic when it is complex, and that only reinforces simplistic judgments, which I think have been harmful. The Bible deserves better treatment. Other mistakes I've heard recently are not very important in themselves either, except that if people paid attention to them, they might become a little more critical of the preachers of the electronic church. I was in Dallas for a wedding some weeks ago, and during an early morning workout, while my host was asleep, I ran on the treadmill in his exercise room. To keep from being bored, I watched first Oral Roberts and then Jimmy Swaggart. I'm not allowed to watch them at home. Oral was talking about a magical number, 0.1%, and how this was God's way of handling a crisis. I kept thinking, where did he find that? Have I read every line of the Bible and taught it all my life and completely missed that? Well, it turned out that this was the magical number of contributors God needed from the viewing audience to save the TV show. And here is how Oral got it. He reminded us of the famous debate between God and Abraham, in which Abraham says, "Will you save Sodom, that wicked city, if there are 50 good men in it?" God says, "Yes." Abraham says, "How about if 5 are lacking? You wouldn't destroy the city for the lack of 5, would you?" God says, "I'll not destroy it if we can find 45. Abraham says, "How about 40? God says, "Okay, 40. 30? Okay, I'll go for 30. How about 20? I'll go for 20. And then Abraham pushes his luck as far as he thinks he dares. How about 10? God says, I'll even go for 10. And so ends one of the oddest haggling deals in the history of any religion anywhere on the face of this earth. But what does that final 10 have to do with Orell's remark about how important 1/10 of 1% is? Well, says Orell, there were 100,000 people in Sodom. And 10 is 1/10 of 1% of that number. So that's the number God uses in deciding when to save. Therefore, if 1/10 of 1% of all the people listening that day would send cash and checks, God would save the show. Now, I would have thought you were pulling my leg if you had told me this, but I saw and heard it. It's a strange way to manipulate figures, especially figures that have been pulled out of a hat. No one has any evidence at all about the population of Sodom, except that 100,000 would seem incredible. Biblical archaeologists are more likely to guess at a few hundred people for the population. Orell's arithmetic and his use of it are both nonsense, but there were listeners that day who believed they were part of God's magical number and so mailed their checks. Now, I hadn't quite shaken off that experience before Jimmy Swaggart came on screen to talk about the Jewish people crossing the Jordan River into the Promised Land after their long sojourn in the desert. What amazed me was to hear him say solemnly that the Jordan River was 1.5 miles wide. The Jordan is a very small stream, as some of you in this audience know by experience, and it has been a small stream all through historical time. The valley is wide enough, and back in the Pleistocene era of geologic time, the river may have been much wider, but that era has nothing to do with Moses and the Hebrews. I can only guess that Jimmy wanted to make the crossing even more dramatic than the old story makes it. But if you read it carefully, you learn that 1.5 miles wide river is unsupported by anything in the narrative and is made highly improbable by several of the things which are there. There is, in fact, so much carelessness in radio and TV religion that I thought there should be a special name for it. And I finally found one which sounds a little bit like a government bureau, but describes much of what one hears nowadays in the name of the gospel: the Ministry of Misinformation. It may not sound important to talk about such trivial matters, particularly since you probably do not listen to those programs anyway, but the truth is we all get tarred with the same brush. When religion is ignorant, and nobody challenges the ignorance, or even worse, scandalous, every single one of us who is committed to the value of church life is hurt. The television church, with its showmanship and glitter, is no substitute for the local church and has in many ways harmed it. An image and a voice can plead for money And a computer can send you a form letter that says, Jesus loves you and we need your check. But no one will visit your bedside or come to the nursing home. The notion that you find the love Jesus promised by getting on a mailing list is a cruel joke. There is no substitute for a gathered company of human beings at worship, complete with shared laughter and handshakes, even the occasional dispute and angry word. These are real life joys and sorrows. Television churches entertain, but the life of faith is more than entertainment. We are not under the bright lights all the time. We live among the slow of speech, as well as among the gifted. In our world, the coffee gets cold, the kids in the pageant forget their lines, prodigal sons and daughters wander in and out of the church looking for themselves and looking for our forgiveness, even when they don't quite know that yet. Sometimes we are stupid and mean. Sometimes we are warm and loving. And sometimes when we're all trying to carry the tune of the same song, caught up together in the same high hopes, grieving together at the same funeral, it seems the kingdom has really come. But we have to be there. It's not the same as watching a religious show on television. There is some attendance loss to the local church, I think, and some monetary loss when several $100 million are spent to keep the studios glossy and the condos, planes, and boats available for the pulpit entrepreneurs. But there is a psychic loss that bothers me a great deal more. To think that Christian faith, embodied once in a person who did his loving work in face-to-face intimacy, should now be embodied in an enterprise fed by cable, hawked into the eyes of a camera, a kind of game show of the spirit where marginal talent croons adulatory love songs into handheld mics, swaying in chiffon dresses and loaded with expensive jewelry, a kind of showing off for Jesus, an equation of religion with stage show entertainment. Somewhere along the way, surely, we lost track of the way. I would never hope for a moment to win any of that vast television audience as part of this one. But I can think of at least one great advantage. If millions who now watch and support the electronic church were to turn off their sets, they might turn to each other to play Scrabble, tell stories, wrestle with the kids, reminisce, or read a book if they are alone, so that they can talk about it when they are no longer alone. We're built to need each other. Love can't be kept to itself, and relationships die on the vine of isolation. As for the church, it's still down on the street corner, in every town, covered with warts, but full of real people, with ministers who have to perform without the help of sophisticated cue cards and electronic enhancement and huge sound stages and a cast of hundreds before and behind the camera, with audiences that have driven from their houses down actual streets, to touch another person's hand, to say hello, how do you feel, how is Betty doing, how did the operation go, are your children well, do you need someone at your house? People, certainly who are not always perfect, who fluff their lines and can't do anything about it because they're on live, but real people in churches, on street corners that are real churches. I don't know what the lasting result will be of the greed and manipulation we have discovered in the last few weeks behind the cameras, but I certainly know what I hope. That it will make us think long and hard about the artificiality, the showbiz approach to worship, the glitter and hype in the name of a simple rabbi and son of God, and make us value once again the authenticity of the church down the block. The one we'll need for the christening, for the wedding, for the funeral, for the quiet hour of recreation on Sunday morning, when our neighbors, looking real, with hair still mussed and eyes a little sleepy, show up to remind us that we are a community, that we cannot live the life of faith in the din, in front of the tube, watching stars who will be light years away, when in our own life the darkness falls.